Explore the tropics at Whole Foods Market through April 16th. Save on juicy finds like yellow mangoes at 5 for $5 with Prime. Sweet Dacopan citrus is back, just $3.49 per pound with Prime. Plus, save on seasonal favorites like dragon fruit, kiwi, pineapple, and more. In the meat department, pick up animal welfare certified meats with tropical-inspired marinades. And be sure to try the spicy Hawaiian pizza, back for a limited time, only at Whole Foods Market.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower. Now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Welcome to another episode of Strictly Business, the podcast in which we speak with some of the brightest minds working in the media business today. I'm Andrew Wallenstein with Variety. This week, a special doubleheader edition of the pod. That's right, we're giving you two great back-to-back interviews that were recorded on September 15th at Variety's Entertainment and Technology Summit in Los Angeles, presented by City National Bank. First, a rare one-on-one with the chairman of Disney Media and Entertainment Distribution, Kareem Daniel. He's kept a relatively low profile in a high-visibility role at the company. But Variety co-editor-in-chief Cynthia Littleton got him to sit down and break his silence. And after that, I spend time with an industry veteran who doesn't know from silence, Blumhouse founder Jason Blum. He's not only one of Hollywood's most successful producers, but one of its most candid ones to boot. He and his company's new president, Abhijay Prakash, opened up about the current state of movies and profit participation. Strictly Business will be back in just a moment.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
As we wave goodbye to winter's chill, it's time to give our lawn a little love and embrace the freshness of spring. And guess what? The Home Depot's Spring Black Friday sale is here to make it all a breeze. Snag the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and say goodbye to tedious yard work. With a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power, your lawn will look spotless in a flash. And the best part? Thanks to the convenience of online shopping, you can effortlessly place your order via the app, cruise into the store for pickup, and find yourself chilling in your freshly spruced up yard in no time. Don't let this awesome deal blow away. Get your hands on the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for only $89. Yeah, just $89. Exclusively during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Waiting on a tax return? Hopefully it ends up in your hands. fraudulent tax returns due to identity theft increased by 30% in 2023. If you're in a bind this tax season, LifeLock can help. LifeLock monitors and alerts you to identity threats you may miss on your own, even if you're careful with your personal information. And if you do become the victim of tax-related identity fraud, LifeLock has U.S.-based restoration specialists ready to help solve identity theft issues on your behalf. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. Why wait for your tax refund in vain? Help protect your information immediately with LifeLock. Go to LifeLock.com/iHeart and save up to 25% your first year. That's 25% off at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Identity theft protection starts here.
Here's Cynthia and Kareem Daniel.
Personally, I've had a pretty fortunate set of diverse experiences from a career standpoint, both, I'd say, within and without the company. I actually started off as a computer programmer. I spent some time on Wall Street. The thing that was always in the back of my mind was a true passion for entertainment. Film was what I grew up on. That was my outlet, and ultimately I made a decision to exit a career path and try to get into the entertainment industry. And I went back to business school and had to fight to get an internship at the Walt Disney Company. Actually, it was for Bob Chapek's organization when he was running Home Entertainment. And
a fortuitous meeting, of course. Bob Chapek, now the CEO of Disney.
It was fortuitous indeed. To actually be in a film studio was just something that I'd always dreamt of, and I just didn't know my angle into it. And certainly having that opportunity, it was a great summer experience. Of course, this is an entertainment company, so there's no, and then we'll hire you. So I had to kind of fight to get into Disney yet again once I graduated, and I went into corporate, and ultimately I got an opportunity to go back to the studio when Bob became not just head of home entertainment, but all of distribution. So his responsibilities extended from theatrical to home entertainment to television to digital, and his goal was to harmonize across all of those platforms to optimize the performance of the film, which sounds very familiar to what DMED does today, but
right.
At that time, that was pretty revolutionary.
It was an early kind of a precursor to that idea of that this content is going to go everywhere. It's not just going to go through that one channel.
That's exactly right. This is 2010. I think the first picture.
It feels a long time ago.
Right. It was Alice in Wonderland. Was in March, and we wanted to shrink the window a bit from 4 months to three.
Oh yes, I remember that was.
Which was a very big deal at the time. There's a lot of you're going to ruin the box office. You're going to destroy the paradigm. We didn't destroy the paradigm. The film did quite well. It destroyed box office records. It did $1 billion. Mm-hmm. I think it's still a top 10 release in the month of March. So it was a precursor to what we're doing now, mm-hmm. frankly.
Yeah, that's an interesting example, though.
It was a fantastic example. So, I've had a lot of experience at Walt Disney Company, film studio being one. But I was in Imagineering at the beginning of COVID, which I would say was one of the most special experiences I could have. Mm-hmm. Being in one of the most creative organizations in the Walt Disney Company or in the world, frankly, and really getting a sense of the passion and heart that goes into creating, frankly, things that have entertained people for 50 years and will entertain them for the next 50. And leading into DMED, I'd say that this experience gave me more insight and preparation for this role than I would have thought, in that I was in a creative group and another group had the business decisions.
Right. And this is in Imagineering, and you were president
Correct.
Of operations of Imagineering.
That's right.
So, a big gig there.
And we're
wrangling those Imagineers.
Exactly. Well, the Imagineers, by the way, I made so many great friends there and learned a lot about the creative process that I truly appreciate. But I also was able to understand what's it like to not have control over ultimate business decisions.
Right.
So you fast forward to this new organization, we're 2 years old next month. Mm-hmm. So we've been at it a little while. Where DMED, our organization, has that ultimate business authority, and then there's incredibly talented content teams that are making things that are entertaining people all over the world. I feel like I have a bit of understanding of what that's like, having spent time in a creative organization without that ultimate authority, where I know that collaboration is absolutely critical. You can't operate a business without having a true appreciation and connection with that creative group. So a lot of experiences, but I try to draw on all of them mm-hmm. in this new role.
Let me ask you, in moving from, you know, consumer products and distribution, working with the Imagineering group, were those sort of opportunities that came up, or was it a strategic, did you have your eye, I want to have experience here, I want to have experience there?
I do a great job of trying to weave together these experiences in a way that makes it seem planful. And
that's the art, right?
It's certainly not the case. But that's the point. As I said earlier, each of those experiences have yielded something that I draw upon. Mm-hmm. Being in this role for 2 years, it helps to understand consumer products and know that what the Walt Disney Company does is make content that can be used and frankly shared in different types of experiences on many different types of platforms, whether it's consumer products, theme parks, et cetera. Something that the Walt Disney Company does, we'd argue, better than anyone else in the world. That helps that I was there. It helps that I was in Imagineering. Mm-hmm. It helps that I was in corporate strategy and looked at the entire company in totality to try to help determine, frankly, how we can operate better together. And I think that's what we do. It's even now, over the last couple of years, you've heard a lot of, obviously a lot of focus being on streaming. We have a lot of focus on streaming. Mm-hmm. We're very pleased with our progress there, but of course, we're not just a streaming company, just like we're not just a theme parks company, we're not just a consumer products company. Mm-hmm. We may be the best in the world at many of these areas, but it's the Walt Disney Company, and we pull them together in a way that I'd say it's greater than the sum of the parts. And having been in so many different places at the company, I can see how well we do that and collaborate, and I can also see the opportunities to do more, which I think now that we have two business units with Parks and Experiences called DPEP, mm-hmm. and then, of course, Media Entertainment with DMED, we're able to do that in a much more fluid way. And Disney Plus, frankly, is going to be key for that going forward.
Let me ask you. So, as you know, as again, most people know, big transition at Disney in February 2020. Bob Chapek took over as CEO from Bob Iger. Of course, we know what happened the next month in 2020. A little, you know, quite a fraught time. At some point, I'm guessing in the late summer, fall, you got a call from Bob Chapek and said, "Kareem, I have a job for you." Can you talk about how you the discussions that led you to the chairman post at DMED?
Sure. First, I have to acknowledge your point, though, with regard to D23. It's just a moment to sit back and just be amazed at the creative talent at this company.
The breadth is amazing.
The breadth is insane. And when you look at Avatar: The Way of the Water, as you said, The Way of Water, but we also have Black Panther, Wakanda Forever, two of the most highly anticipated features this year, if not ever, coming out. And you look at what we just dropped with Little Mermaid and essentially breaking the internet with, it's just so touching and sweet, the reaction there. Tonight we've got Andor premiere. It's just so much happening right now that it gives you a moment of respite of, okay, we certainly have the most amazing content and that makes our jobs that much easier. So I have to acknowledge that. I'm glad you brought it up. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the creation of this position, I think ultimately the way we've thought about it is there's excellence in making, there's excellence in actual, more the business and running the P&L aspects of that can be separate. And we've done that to success elsewhere, as I mentioned, Imagineering. And when it comes down to it, DMED has two responsibilities. Fundamentally, it's looking at content investment and it's looking at distribution strategies. And it isn't a situation where And I know it's been confusing because there's so many different companies with different paradigms. Fundamentally for us, we are tasked with looking at each and every platform, whether it's networks, theatrical, or streaming, and determining what growth we anticipate or we will expect of ourselves to generate. So it isn't that content creators create something and then we just figure out, okay, it should go here or there. It's much more planful, it's intentional, it's strategic the way we look at it. So looking at each of those platforms, whether it's networks, theatrical or streaming, what should the investment levels be? And based upon our knowledge of the consumer and what's resonating, we look on those platforms to determine what types of content would best drive that growth. We share that with our content partners, and of course they create at a level that no one else in the world does, and they generate the incredible content that those talented groups deliver to those platforms in a way that drives that growth. We may determine strategically to make changes when we have to. We have a flexible strategy, of course. The pandemic was a test of that flexibility, which we're pleased with what we learned during that period of time. But going forward, we believe in the theatrical market. We know what we're going to do there with regard to continuing. We're number one in a global box office 6 years in a row. We don't anticipate that changing anytime soon. We know what the theatrical marketplace can do, creating a cultural zeitgeist through features that then inevitably get played out across the entirety of the Walt Disney Company. And we're very set on how that's going to go in the future. And we're able to do things, though, that we weren't able to do 2 years ago. And I'll give you an example. When you think of something theatrically like Thor: Love and Thunder, great film, comes out, fantastic. Ultimately, it's going to go onto the service, meaning Disney Plus. Well, you also look at our networks group, which we manage as well, and you look at something like FX that has tremendous content on it, but it also has some third-party content. And they go out and they will get a film from perhaps another studio outside of the Walt Disney Company. Mm-hmm. We saw an opportunity to do this where Thor: Love and Thunder, we have Thor, the first three films in the Thor franchise. Let's take those three films that are on Disney Plus, put them on FX in a way that gives Thor that much more exposure, yields benefit to the theatrical release of Love and Thunder, where you just get more Thor out there. We're not going to cannibalize one single subscriber on Disney Plus. In fact, across the bottom of that screen, when you're watching FX, Thor 1, 2, or 3, it says the rest of Thor, of this and the other two, and all of the Avengers
more hammers
are playing 24/7 on Disney Plus. That's harmonizing across our platforms in a way, frankly, we couldn't do in a different organizational structure. So that really epitomizes the...
Because everybody's incentives are aligned in the same way.
And it's with one group actually being able to make those determinations, it helps. We have Handmaid's Tale Season 5 coming out. We just took Handmaid's Tale Season 1, Episode 1, and we put it on FX. And we saw Seasons 1 through 4 on Hulu got a significant lift just by putting it on FX. So
on
it
the
helps
linear FX.
We put it on linear FX, and it popped the prior seasons 1 through 4 as people are seeing, oh, okay, episode 1, season 1, I want to see the rest of season 1, 2, 3, 4, in advance of 5 coming out. That's just the type of interplay that we have by actually managing all of these platforms, that it's truly hitting our stride now when we're able to do strategic things like that with tactical implementations that we're seeing resonate with consumers.
And you can actually see, like, a linear airing
literally
drives people to the digital.
The numbers would be surprising.
That is
the pop that occurred on the Handmaid's Tale library on Hulu by airing that episode on FX.
That's amazing. Let me ask him, so for a tough call, for a tough decision, a show, you've had a show for two seasons, you know, you've invested some in the show. The tough call, it's sort of on the bubble, as they used to say, about a season three renewal. Who makes the decision, we're not going to renew this? Or who makes the decision, you know what, there's something here, this is going to grow in season four, we are going to renew that. Who makes those calls?
Well, fortunately, we don't have a lot of examples to draw upon because the content teams are just creating some fantastic things. We weigh a lot of different factors in terms of whether we should go forward or not. And a lot of that does require faith in our content teams, where you know your story arc, you know what is happening. Sometimes you'll have a season one where you know you have to get through certain things, establishing characters and a fundamental storyline, but you know where that's going in a second season, even if it's not performing that well in that first season or as well as we would like. You know what it's going to do in the second season, and it's going to yield benefit because that library will maintain. If we're talking about a streaming service, it'll be there. And that is something that we rely upon our content teams for, certainly. But ultimately, we do have the responsibility to drive the growth of these platforms. And if something is not performing, then we're going to have to make that call, as tough as it may be, that it's not working on the service. It is, and we're maniacally focused, of course, on hitting the profitability that we've established as a key goal mm-hmm. in FY24, and we're confident we're going to hit that.
I'm guessing Christine McCarthy has a countdown clock in her office. Christine McCarthy is the CFO of Disney.
Absolutely. Christine and I are extremely aligned on a number of things, including hitting that profitability. So if we have to make those hard decisions at times, then we will.
Is it fair to say it's a collaborative decision? It's a you conversation. It's a Dana Walden conversation. It's a Craig Erwick who runs Hulu's originals. It's a collaborative conversation.
Literally everything we do at the Walt Disney Company is collaborative. I'll give you an example. My first week, we were working on a deal. Don't have to get into the details about it. And the team was presenting it out. And I just asked, what does Content Team X think about it? And the answer was, not sure. We haven't asked. And I immediately called the head of that content team and asked. I understand where that responsibility now resides. But the idea that we would not ask for the opinion of a colleague that had previously had that responsibility is not how we operate DMET, fundamentally. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad it happened early, and I'm glad it set a tone for how we've operated for the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Let's talk a bit about, of course, streaming has been the only topic of conversation in media for some years now. It kicked off, I think, by Disney going for it with Disney Plus. Let's talk a little bit. Our time is flying by here, but let's talk about the linear side of the Disney TV universe, which is, you know, box office and TV. That is what, and parks, of course. Yeah. But I mean, television is such an engine of and the channels, the existing, the traditional cable channels, ESPN, the Disney channels, its spinoffs, Freeform. You know, there's a sense that the linear world is the melting ice cube. That is, it's still a big generator of earnings and profits, but it is a melting ice cube, and that's why the big investment in streaming. How are you, because you are responsible now for doing the deal for ESPN with Comcast and Charter and getting those traditional linear distribution for the traditional cable channels, as well as plotting the future for Disney Plus and Hulu and everything. How do you approach the management of the linear ESPN, the linear Freeform? Of course, ESPN has been in the headlines a little bit. There's been some discussion about there's been some discussion, should Disney sell it or spin it off? Bob Chapek spoke back to those suggestions. Thank you very much. I'd like to keep ESPN. But can you talk about, I'm not asking you to comment on that, I know, but can you talk about how you are managing those assets? And is it fair to say they are melting ice cubes and it's a manage of managing the melt? Or do you see that we are overestimating the decline there?
Well, I often think looking at industries is important. But if you look at historically what the Walt Disney Company has done, that we have exceeded and perhaps even led those industries despite the fundamentals that may occur in the industries in which we participate. And what I mean by that is, you mentioned ESPN. It's the number one cable network, again, 5 years in a row. ABC, number one, primetime entertainment, 3 years in a row. I can keep going. There's a lot here, going to Freeform, FX, and so forth. We continue to perform well in those areas. That said, streaming is a massive part of our future, and our job at DMED is to balance across networks and streaming and theatrical. That means we know what the growth we want to achieve in networks, we know we want to achieve in box office, and we invest appropriately. And again, the content teams are creating amazing content against that, and it's not a one or the other type situation. I won't give out specific stats, but look at something like The Old Man that actually debuted on FX, the linear channel.
The Jeff Bridges drama.
Which is fantastic.
Terrific vehicle for him.
And I couldn't be more excited about what that is going to look like in the future for The Old Man, or what that's going to look like. And we were talking about the Emmys backstage. I think that's a fantastic show. Its viewership on the linear FX, of course, at midnight it goes on to Hulu, the streaming service, is non-cannibalistic. So we're actually reaching more audiences than, or more parts of the audience than we otherwise would have with just a streaming or a linear component. And that's the criticality of DMED, is that we're able to look across all of these platforms, not at the expense of another one, right? It is fundamentally, we're going to drive streaming growth. We have our goals. We are going to hit those goals, but we can also have tremendous success in networks and theatrical. And I know there's more focus on the other parts of the Walt Disney Company, perhaps outside of the company these days. We've always had the focus internally about the variety of platforms that we have in DMED, or the variety of experiences and touch points that we have across the Walt Disney Company with consumers. That is no less of a priority now than it ever has been. And we tie these organizations together in a way that again, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And we look at things like even Disney Plus Day, which we had a week ago today. And it's a fantastic opportunity where if you're a Disney Plus subscriber, you get into the parks early, whether it's Disney World, Disneyland, Disneyland Paris, what have you, you get exclusive merchandise from consumer products. There's a lot of things that you get as a benefit of being a Disney Plus subscriber across the Walt Disney Company. And it seems like just one day, the things that we're doing along these lines are fundamentally what we want to provide every day to those that are within the Disney family to the degree that they opt in and want to participate across all of these different venues. We can enhance each of those experiences. I mentioned the parks earlier. If you go to a park and you have a meet and greet with the princess, I'd argue that's probably the best park and the best meet and greet that you can have in the industry. Come home, and again, provided that that family wants to opt into such an experience, shouldn't Disney Plus be a little bit more tailored towards princess for those consumers? That's something that we can do. And again, I've spent time working on some of these rides that I know are built on game engines, and they could be more responsive and dynamic with regard to what types of stories are serving up to you. If consumers want to be a part of this experience, when we think a lot of people are going to want that, based upon what you've experienced on Disney Plus or with consumer products, et cetera, can we now offer you a different experience, a more specialized, personalized experience once you're on that ride at one of our parks? Those are the things that we're working on. Again, much more cohesively that we frankly believe no other company on the planet can do.
Mm-hmm. And I know that Chapek has talked that there are things coming to ESPN Linear, ESPN Streaming that are going to integrate it, you know, even more into the Disney ecosystem. But let me press you again in that linear world. Are you anticipating some tough conversations coming up as you renew linear ESPN with traditional distributors like Comcast, like Charter? Do you think, I mean, ESPN has always been at the top of the market in terms of fees. Do you think those conversations are going to be tougher in the future?
Well, we've had many of them over the last couple of years. And yes, they were tough.
I guess that's kind of a given. But
they were tough the last cycle and the cycle before that. We have an amazing distribution team that helps the MVPDs understand the true value of what not just ESPN, but our entire suite of networks provide. It's hard to imagine anyone not being able to appreciate really what ESPN does in terms of tying together that core cable bundle. And I think our partners understand that, and they have understood it in these last cycles. Certainly, again, we anticipate those conversations to continue as they always have. But what we've learned from our partners is that they understand the same thing that we see with our consumers is the true value of ESPN to that bundle. And we continue to yield incredible value out of it, not just specifically as it accrues to ESPN, but the entirety of our cable networks as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, our time is running short. I want to ask you about Hulu, because there's a lot in the world about Hulu. I want to ask you specifically about Hulu Live, that service, which is basically a digital MVPD. Let me ask you a skeptical question. Is that a real business for you, or is that an add-on that Hulu offers to some consumers? But the bulk of your Hulu now stands at 46.2 total subscribers, and of those, 4 million take the Hulu Live channel package. It's been flat the last couple of quarters in terms of that growth in that area. Is that something that is something that you think can grow, or do you think that is something that is a value added, but that's not a growth area for Hulu?
Well, we certainly believe in Hulu Live as a product, and we also believe, again, anything that we do is we believe in its own right, but also the value that it yields to the rest of the company. And with our last price increase for Hulu Live, we enabled all of those subscribers to also get the Disney bundle. That is a significant benefit, of course, for our streaming services as well. Again, it's all about looking at every touch point, optimizing that, and we are doing that with Hulu Live, making that experience better and better. But we're also able to leverage that for the rest of the company, and that's, frankly, something we just do quite well, and we have found ways to do that even with Hulu Live. So we believe in that business in its own right, as well as for the benefits that accrue to the rest of our company as well.
Is that Disney bundle, is that a growth engine in and of itself? Are you finding more people that come to you come in for the bundle rather than one of the services? The bundle is, if I'm not mistaken, Disney Plus, Hulu, and ESPN Plus at this moment.
Correct, and there's a lot of talk about fundamentally, oh, there's so many different services. Well, that's what we were able to provide to consumers, one cohesive solution where you have the premium general entertainment with Hulu in the U.S., and I would challenge anyone who's got better content on a platform than Hulu right now, whether it's The Bear, The Patient, Prey, Dropout, Dope Sick, you just keep going. And I know what the slate looks like as well, so I know we will keep going. You add that to the best branded platform out there from a streaming perspective with Disney Plus and the number one sports streaming service out there with ESPN Plus. We are providing a cohesive solution for families of all different types of demographics and sizes and interests. And that's what the Disney bundle provides. And we have found the more that we get consumers to actually experience this bundle, the more likely that they're to stay and remain in our ecosystem, meaning our churn goes down significantly. We have great churn numbers that we're pleased with on Disney Plus or Hulu or ESPN Plus. But when you have all three and you can actually have the totality of what we have to offer from a streaming standpoint, consumers have found tremendous value in that, and they stay around even longer. So, yes, we want more people to adopt the Disney bundle, and we're happy with that progress as well.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us a sense, though, like in recent months, do you have more people come in the door just for Disney Plus, or are you finding a lot of uptake on the bundle?
I would say each individual platform continues to grow at pace. The bundle, there's two ways. Either you come in for the bundle, and we've been pleased with that uptake, but once you're in one of them, we have the ability to, of course, cross-sell and get you into the bundle as well. So having those a la cartes have helped be on-ramps into the bundle. So we approach it mirrored ways, and that's just in the U.S. When you look at our content offerings in a place like EMEA, because this is obviously global set of initiatives, our general entertainment content, the same premium content, The Bear, The Patient, Prey, and so forth, resides on Disney Plus in Europe, and that we've seen how that impacts engagement being a great barometer for churn. It is tremendous what that has done in EMEA, and that's our solution there. The Disney bundle is what we're doing in the U.S., and we're quite pleased with that as well. So we try to tailor again. Having a flexible strategy allows us to tailor according to the needs in any particular region, and having the combination of our general entertainment and our branded, plus, frankly, in the U.S., our sports, we believe it's just the best, not just offering, but it's the best value that's out there in any streaming landscape that we've contemplated. So that is what we focus on. But again, each individual service continues to perform as well.
We're going to take a quick commercial break, but when we return, we've got a second interview with the top executives at Hollywood's Masters of Horror, Blumhouse.
As we wave goodbye to winter's chill, it's time to give our lawn a little love and embrace the freshness of spring. And guess what? The Home Depot's Spring Black Friday sale is here to make it all a breeze. Snag the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and say goodbye to tedious yard work. With a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power, your lawn will look spotless in a flash. And the best part? Thanks to the convenience of online shopping, you can effortlessly place your order via the app, cruise into the store for pickup, and find yourself chilling in your freshly spruced up yard in no time. Don't let this awesome deal blow away. Get your hands on the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for only $89. Yeah, just $89. Exclusively during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring? but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
And we're back with Jason Blum and Abhijay Prakash, the lead executives at Blumhouse. Take a listen.
I was curious, in terms of getting into the TV business, where I think you're a little, you know, obviously film, it's much more mature. What did you see as the opportunity there?
We got into the television business because we started to have a consumer-facing brand that was taking hold. And so I thought it would be silly not to exploit that brand in television also. And the complicated thing about TV, and 80% of our movie business is horror and 20% is kind of other. TV is almost reverse. It's about 75% other, 25% horror. Now the other is, it's a broad definition. It's dark themes. We did a show called The Loudest Voice in the Room about Roger Ailes. Now, it wasn't a horror show, but he was a horrible guy. So that's how it's kind of, we tangentially related to Blumhouse. The complicated thing for us in our television business is that the DNA of our company is that we work on commission. We don't get fees. That's just so built into our process on the movie side. We don't get a producing fee. We get a piece of the profits. The more successful we are, the bigger that piece is. And I, as a business person, producer, entrepreneur, am much more comfortable in that model. I'm much more comfortable going to someone and getting a big check if I'm not getting a piece of the check. If I'm saying to the person, I love this, pay for it, I'm not going to make any money until you do, or until this show does. And I think the complicated thing is that the TV business just doesn't work that. You can beg all you want to work for nothing and get paid in success, and they won't do that. You know, everyone gets paid up front, and you negotiate for as much as you can up front before you make the thing that you're making. And I spiritually find that complicated.
Well, let's get into that, because that's, you know, a big issue in the industry, perhaps the biggest. You've written a New York Times op-ed about this. In the streaming age, just to explain to everyone, make sure we all understand, it works on a cost-plus model. All of the streamers, starting with Netflix, but it kind of went to all of them in time, started paying in a way where you would cover the cost of production and get a nice, healthy premium on top of that, maybe 10, 20%. But you're basically signing away all your rights in the process. You just mentioned you want to come at it a completely different way. How are you able to function in this world where basically all the buyers, the biggest buyers in town, want to do different business a lot differently than you do?
Well, like I say, I function, but it's hard. If you think about what you just said, cost plus, they're basically telling the producer to make the show as expensive as it possibly can be, because the more the show costs, the more you're going to get paid. That is crazy. It's just insane. And it's also, to Abhijay's point, like when your whole other company is built on, I got the thing as low as I possibly could, so the profit is as big as possible, so your piece of that profit is as big as possible. You just have to take a whole nother thinking to, like, you every producer, whether they admit this or not, they do the same thing. They do their show, they do their budget is whatever it is, then they say, how much do we actually think we can get from these guys? Add that much and submit it. And the content business across movies and TV, for 100 years, as much data as you have, as good as you think you are at doing the job of picking, no one has ever picked even close to 50%. So 50%, usually 50 to 60% of what you make is not super profitable. And if you're paying everyone up front, you're acting as if almost everything you're doing is profitable. So I think, like my article said, I think it's a challenge system, and I hope one day we'll change it.
Well,
Hope. It still exists in movies.
Yes.
And I hope one day we'll TV will go back to sharing and making shows that are less expensive.
Hope is a nice thing. Abhijay, what steps can a company like yourself take to effectuate change and get the kind of models that you want? Perhaps there's signs already that these changes are happening because clearly we're seeing voices like Jason's, others, people out there who are, you know, making the call as well.
Yeah.
Is there any hope?
Yeah. Well, look, I think, like Jason said, the model has worked extraordinarily well in the film business. And so we try to point that out as much as possible when we're bringing our series business to different buyers. But you said it, right? Jeff Sagansky, Bob Iger, there's other folks who've been talking about how our creators are going to be compensated in a perpetuity cost plus streaming buyout model. You have to change that, right? I think there are some signs that's going to change. If you're looking for silver linings of the sort of Netflix stock market correction and the shift to cash flow as a metric for valuing streaming businesses, there's a different degree of selectivity, judiciousness, and cost consciousness that's now seeping into the way buyers approach buying series. And so in that model, could you have things where projects like ours come in, maybe they're lower budget than the other ones, and so they're more willing to do those. We can either make it up in volume, or more interestingly, to align with what Jason Zapped said, maybe it's not a perpetuity buyout for cost plus. Maybe it's a licensing term and we get rights back later. Maybe there is contingent comp based on viewership, so it lowers what the buyer's paying up front. But then if you hit certain thresholds, right, about overall views relative to the cost of the thing, or you're in a top five ranking over the quarter or the year, you can get some contingent comp. So that is kind of a win-win, where then you're only getting extra money from the buyers in success, where they're getting real value from the show. And it also lowers their upfront cost, which could work for us because we're not always, you know, the budgets that we do, we know how to make things for less cost, right? And so that could really play to our advantage. But I haven't seen examples. Maybe you guys have. No one showed up with that deal yet and put it in front of us. So I think we're going to have to bring it with one of our properties to the market.
I mean, we should explain the logic behind what the streamers are doing is, and perhaps different than the businesses of old that were buying projects, is they are trying to hit a global audience, and they want all those rights in perpetuity. And, you know, is it possible, Jason, there are some producers that are like, look, Blum's got a great track record, but others may be comfortable with getting de-risked and getting that premium in the beginning and, you know, washing their hands with it?
I think there are a lot of producers like that. Yeah. And I think the idea, and that exists in the movie business to a certain degree. You can take a big fee and get a smaller back end, or you can go to the studio and say, I don't want a fee and I want to share more. And most studios are kind of open to haggling a little bit about that. So there's another, to flip what I said on its head, there's another benefit to paying people out. It's like, I always say it's like a little kind of like a communist system, which is the following, which is that you can make shows and movies a little bit different than your point, for a very small audience. You can make art house shows and movies for a small audience and still get paid. So the commercial shows and movies that streamers are doing are subsidizing art, which happens all the time. If you look at the budgets of the last streaming movies in Venice, these are all art house movies. 8 years ago, they would have been $15 to $25 million movies. Now they're $100 million movies. There's no way there's an audience to justify the $100 million, but it's being subsidized by the shows that are hitting by Stranger Things. So they're, in a sense, they're taking from Peter to pay Paul, which is, you know, there's something good about that. But again, I think it would be better if there was more flexibility to it.
Well, we should also point out that part of this Faustian bargain with the streamers is, you get this, you don't get back end, you get this cost plus up front, and you don't get any data. So, Abhijay, how do you fly blind without that? And is there hope there for starting to get that going?
It's a good point. I cited the correction in the way streamers are valued as one thing. The other one is what you just alluded to, Andy, which is this inexorable march towards more openness and transparency around what consumers are doing when it comes to streaming content. And that is going to happen. And once that's out there, right, it's already, you can see Nielsen and other folks trying to, you know, they publish it. Netflix then obviously moved to start to do their top 10. So we're moving in that direction. Samba TV, there's a whole bunch of other data sources out there. So we're moving in that direction. Once that's really out there, you know, you've got agents in the room here, they're going to notice and go, hey, I see what my show did, my client show did. Producers will notice and go, I need to get paid for this. It did 10x what that guy's show did. And I need to be rewarded for that. So that's another way that hopefully we can achieve the goal, which is you're going to be able to have more transparency on what works, right? You at least have a version of that. It's one of the challenges, I think, in from film to TV is that there's less, because so much of the consumption is not driven by linear ratings, which we have access to, but happens inside of streaming universes that you don't have access to. You have box office still as a very relevant metric of how your movie did if it comes out theatrically, which can bolster an argument of going, I need a bonus if it hits 100 million or whatever. We don't have that on TV.
And the only thing I would add to that is because when you add an advertising tier, you have to share data. They're going to have to share data with Ford when Ford is advertising.
Although,
on Netflix.
Like Netflix is trying to get away without it right now, from what I understand.
But that's I think that's well, you know, they've done other things that no one thought they could do. Maybe they'll do that. But I think it'd be very complicated to sell advertising to corporations without sharing data.
So the hope is that as marketers get data, you guys will get as well.
Well, it'll the dam will break.
It arms you, right? You have an argument, right. And you can point to something, right?
Yeah. But while we're doing the military metaphor, I should point out that the big bad streamers aren't as big and bad as they used to be. We've seen the Netflix correction. We've seen really a correction for the whole marketplace. Doesn't that increase the leverage when you come to these negotiations?
I think the correction has made transactional distribution of entertainment not a dirty word again, which is great. You know, I think it's very good. And so the answer is yes. I think streaming is a big part of how content will be distributed, but it's not the only way. And I think that's what we've seen over the last 6 months. And I think that's healthy overall for the entertainment ecosystem.
We should point out you're not exactly a profit participation purist in the sense
not
you
at
have
all.
Done these premium deals.
Not at all.
Great deal with NBC Universal for a reboot of The Exorcist with three different movies, $400 million. So you're not above taking this upfront dollars.
No, not at all. And I you know what? I was thinking about this. I'm going to try it out, man. You'll see if you
go for it.
You could tell me if you think I'm
you're comfortable with
full of shit. Yeah. So here's how I look at that. Like, I think rich people, including me, should pay more taxes, right? But I'm not. And then some people say, well, just give the government more money. Well, a little extra money from me is not going to move the needle on the government. So I'm not going to voluntarily give the government more money because I think rich people should pay more taxes, but I would be very happy if all upper income people, including myself, paid more, right? But I can't, I'm not gonna, so the idea that this system exists, I'm gonna work within the system, but I wish the system was different. Now, do you think that's a fair comparison? Do you think that's fair or
not? I didn't know where you were going.
Do you think that's fair or not?
I understand.
Does that work for you?
Yes, that you live within the system and you have to do what's best for
you. You think I'm still a hypocrite? You could tell me.
I think there's some hypocrisy there, but I'm not calling you a hypocrite. Look, it's business. You know, one last question on this front. Jeff Sagansky has said that you guys should be like petitioning the DOJ and Congress. Is that where this is going to end up?
Boy, I don't know about that.
I don't know enough about how. I don't know enough about it, but if there was some kind of class action on creatives and suppliers to share data and everything else, I'd be the first to join. But I don't know. I don't know the beginning of how to do that. But maybe Jeff can help us.
Yeah, we'll sign his petition.
We'll sign the petition.
Yeah. Just as long as Jeff takes the lead.
No, I'll take the lead even. I just don't know how to do that. Yeah. But I don't know enough about if that's even possible, but I love the idea.
Well, there's big union deals coming up next year. Could that be the place where this comes to a head?
I mean, it's the same thing. We're the producers, artists, craftsmen, we're all aligned on this side.
Yeah.
And get compensated, you know, more fairly, right, for the performance of what we do. And so, yes, that's another angle that could also help, for sure.
Yeah.
All right, let's shift gears and talk a bit about the box office. I'm curious how you guys feel about movies playing in theaters and how long they need in theaters. Is there a one-size-fits-all solution for Blumhouse, or does everything kind of depend on the particular movie that you're talking about?
Yeah. That's you.
I think it is not one-size-fits-all. It does vary movie by movie. You can just look at what's happened with our films to see that, right? You've got things, you know, we did a movie with Focus called Vengeance that's on a very different scale than Halloween, and we had Firestarter, and we have Halloween Ends coming up that's day and date, and then we have Black Phone, and those all had, you know, different models of how they came, how they got released. And so it's not one size fits all. We're trying to figure out what the right optimal one is. It's a guess. You don't get to, like, do a controlled A-B test and then figure it out. So you look at the movie and you have an assessment with our partners, and then you try to arrive at the release plan that makes the most sense. And for the most part, we've done it pretty well. And I think demonstrated some things that people did not think was possible. Halloween's probably the best example, where you had a movie come out that was day and date. Like, oh, it's going to crush the box office. Who would ever leave the house? And it worked great in the box office, right? Opened to $50 million. And was a massive success on streaming, right? Which people, you kind of have this very easy, I don't mean to pick on folks in the press, opposition that people like to write about theatrical versus streaming. We think those things actually support each other. And ultimately, everything ends up on streaming, just sometimes it starts on theatrical, and sometimes it starts on theatrical with a window, like you have up there, and sometimes it starts on theatrical day and date. So yeah, we absolutely think about it along with our partners about what the right thing is for each movie.
Jason, how are you feeling about the box office these days? It's been quite a year where if we talked in the middle of the summer, you'd probably be, like a lot of people, very optimistic. Look at Top Gun going to $1 billion. But as we've come into the fall, it's looking like box office for the year will probably be down at least 20% compared to 2019. So the future of exhibition, broadly speaking, are you feeling good?
I don't know if I was saying I'm feeling good. I'm feeling optimistic. I think it's never going to be what it was. I think what is clear is there's a certain kind of movie that is still working. Luckily, horror is one of those. You know, it's horror and big tentpole Marvel-type movies. So I think those are two kinds of movies that are still working theatrically. And I'm happy about that. I think there, you know, I think the adult drama, I think there will be adult dramas released theatrically, but certainly it was challenged before, it's even more challenged now. So I think the theatrical business, it's going to change shape. With my friends in exhibition aside for a second, the actual health of the motion picture business is excellent right now, because the press doesn't report on this well, no offense. The amount of ancillary value a movie makes is almost twice what it was 5 years ago. So if I have a movie that makes $100 million, the amount of money I'm going to make from all the ancillaries is almost equivalent to a movie that 5 years ago would have been $200 million. So even though the box office may be off 10 to 20%, the other side of it, which is the ancillary value of the movies that are released theatrically, is almost twice. So the overall health of the movie business, I actually feel, is very good. Theatrical is more challenged than it was. That will be more challenged than it was before the pandemic.
Speaking of,
do you agree or disagree?
No, I think that's bang on. I add a couple things, which is, you know, we happen to know a little bit about how it worked at studios when the models changed. Jason's 100% right. Some of that stuff you couldn't know because it happens below the waterline. You don't know. PVOD results are not publicly reported. SVOD streaming is not publicly reported. But we see it, of course, because we know how our movies are exploited. And film studios share data.
Exactly.
So you know that we're getting a lot of tremendous value. So each dollar of box office, like Jason said, is worth way more now, which is great for the movies that get a theatrical release. On top of that, we have not increased, or the studios haven't increased, how much they spend on marketing, right? So not only are you getting that return, and you've added windows that are earlier, to your slide's point, that don't require extra marketing. So the marketing's basically stayed flat. It's spread out a little bit differently. And so you've got no real increase in the cost side. You've got much more revenue coming in on the revenue side, even if it's not all in box office, it's happening below, which can absorb any reduction in theatrical paint. And then the last thing I'd say is there's still an active alternative way of monetizing these movies now via streaming, right? Think about where we were 3-4 years ago. Like, big giant movies have debuted on streaming between Netflix and Amazon and what Sony and Paramount did with their slates and Peacock and Disney Plus. And so now you have an alternative outlet that is much more robust for big theatrical quality motion pictures that get sold to streaming. So if you put all that together in the movie studio, you go like, all right, the theatrical business has a theatrical first release business has greater health to it because of the way economics have changed. And I still have vibrant alternatives by debuting things on streaming.
Vengeance. What did it make? 2.6? 3.1?
Oh, no, box office, I think we're doing about 4.
Oh, right? 4. Okay, 4. I thought it did 3. Actually, 4 probably says gap, but I thought it did like 3, 3.5.
Something like
5 that. Years ago, if it did 3 to 3.5, the movie would not have broken. We would have lost money on the movie. Now we're going to actually make a little money on Vengeance, which is amazing. Just to my point, but go on. What were you going to say?
Well, but aren't there going to be fewer movies going to theaters? And if there are, does that work against your business?
What do you think about that?
I think that there could be fewer overall, but like Jason said, we're lucky that our focus is in the horror space, which is clearly one of the most resilient genres when it comes to theatrical, right? People love that experience of seeing scary movies in theaters. So there could be fewer theatrical releases. I think that's entirely possible. That could be a reaction, like Jason said, adult dramas, what they used to look like in 2008, 2009, 2015 could look more. That trend was already happening. It's been accelerated due to COVID. So there could be fewer of those that come out in the world, or they're made at a lower cost base and they have more targeted marketing to them. So I don't know on the overall volume. There will probably be some reduction in theatrical movie going versus 2019. Let's see, though. We're still early in the recovery period, and maybe by 2023 and 2024 that could change. But that's a fair assumption. I don't think we're the only ones who are saying that. All the analysts have a version of that. But even if there are fewer movies, the stuff that we make has still seems like it's doing extraordinarily well. Look at Black Phone and some of the other horror movies that other studios did. So I think from our point of view that there's incredible health and robustness in theatrical. And like we said, you still have all that downstream benefit where streaming actually helps us make more money when you couple it with box office.
Yeah, the movie business is going to be much more profitable than it's ever been before, but the box office may not be as high as it was before.
And I would imagine there's probably going to be some serious shrinkage of the footprint of theaters worldwide?
Some. I mean, there's definitely going to be some shrinkage. There's too many screens. You probably know per market.
Yeah, I mean, people definitely have that view, like in certain markets, that there's overscreening. You see examples of it here, right? Some screens shuttered in the U.S. over the course of the pandemic that probably don't come back, and now you have a Cineworld, you know, bankruptcy process happening, and probably some of those locations don't come back. But fewer screens, there's a lot of capacity. I think theatrical exhibition has like 15-20% usage, utilization. So there's still room to gross as much as you need to on any given movie, and even if there's slightly fewer screens.
So you're bullish on theatrical. Does that mean you guys wouldn't do...
Bullish on the movie business.
Yeah. Right.
Got it.
Yes.
So meaning there'll be some Blumhouse movies that go straight to streaming, some that will play in theaters, right?
Some with accelerated windows that do both, sure.
Okay.
Or the movie that did 30 and would have done 50 will do better, even though it's only doing 30. Even though what else gets written about is, this movie only did 30, it would have done 60. But actually, this movie that just did 30 will ultimately make us more money than the one that did 65 years ago.
Well, okay, so in the TV business, are you feeling, 5 years from now, do you think Blumhouse will be known as much for TV as it is now for film?
We have success in TV. We did the show Thing About Pam. It was a hit for Peacock, but I would like ongoing series success equivalent to our movie business success, and we don't have that, and I hope that in 5 years we'll have a few of those.
Okay.
I mean, if you think about Jason alluded to it earlier, the brand and what it's become from where it started and how meaningful it is, I don't think any one of us know exactly what the consumer landscape is going to look like in 5 years. What are people going to be spending their time on as entertainment consumers? TV series and film Gosh, for sure, we hope so. It feels like that trend, like we just talked about, would be there. But are there other places that people spend their time? You had, you know, a robust discussion around audio right before us. I know we joked around about it a little bit. We're in that business too, right? We have a partnership there. If that's where consumers are spending more time, we can lean into that. And there's relevance for what we do, storytelling in the genre space that could extend into other formats, right? We are a big part of Universal's Halloween Horror Nights experience, right? So it's a live location-based experience. Maybe there's a lot more that's there. And I don't know if you guys have talked all about the metaverse. If the metaverse starts writing checks for storytellers and then anybody who's a fan of Blumhouse, and we happily will create content in that space too. So I think we're open to taking what's been created with this brand, this connection we have with consumers, and the passion for storytelling in that space that we've got, and extending it to other areas. Certainly TV is the realm that we're in right now that we want to grow.
So last question, 5 years out, again, what any ideas of what marketplace you guys will be playing in? I assume I'll go first. Fewer streamers, there'll be consolidation.
Right.
What else do you think will happen over that time?
Boy, yeah. I mean, you already, there's like a headline every day about, oh, they're thinking about consolidating operations between this streaming outlet and that streaming outlet. So you didn't really go out on a limb there, Andy.
Sorry. Come up with something risky.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. To me, the biggest question are all these new spaces in the gaming, metaverse, short-form content area. There seems like there's a lot of money and noise. I, for myself, have not figured out practically what that could look like yet, but really interested in knowing if anybody does have it. And then I do think there'll still be really healthy businesses for movies and for series. But that's, you know, my guess. I don't know if, Jason, you have one.
They'll be sharing and streaming.
That's
my prediction.
How soon?
Yes, 5 years. Yeah, I'm giving.
I gave you five. Okay.
Yeah, you in five lines.
Will you be
in
getting
5 years? Well, everyone will realize that's a better model. You get better shows and movies at a more reasonable price, and that will happen.
And you'll get data too.
And we'll get. They can't share without sharing data, so we'll get data too.
Yeah. All right, you guys are gonna.
That's my prediction.
You guys are gonna have to come back in 2028.
We're here.
Do this again.
Book us.
Yeah.
Excellent. Thanks
Thank
for coming
you.
In, guys.
This has been another episode of Strictly Business. Tune in next week for another helping of scintillating conversation with media movers and shakers. And please make sure you subscribe to the podcast to hear future episodes. Also, leave a review in Apple Podcasts and let us know how we're doing.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases, and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.